in the center of the Himalayan arc, dropping to about 16 millimeters a year in the east. Thus, the Indian plate is descending beneath the Himalaya at around 3/4 of an inch per year. Prithvi Narayan Shah, founder of modern Nepal in 1768, described Nepal as a gourd being squeezed between two hard rocks, Roger said. He was expressing a political sentiment when he wrote this, but the analogy holds up just as well in the geophysical sense. Because of the enormous forces of friction that must be overcome for India to slide northward beneath the Himalaya, the zone of contact between the Himalaya and India holds fast for hundreds of years, until sufficient forces build up to overcome this friction. Where there are no great earthquakes, the plates aren't slipping, but rather a squeezing the Himalaya, like the winding of a terrific spring, Roger explained. The resulting buildup of elastic energy must eventually be released in the form of a catastrophic quake. In mere moments, parts of the Himalaya south of us may leap 5 meters, and possibly more than 10 meters, toward the plains of India. So how much time must elapse before this convergent stress overcomes friction at the base of the Himalaya? A clue can be found in the surface ruptures of historical earthquakes. We know that great earthquakes start in the north beneath the high peaks and rupture 58 miles southward, moving the mountains and villages of Nepal dozens of feet southward, ending roughly 30 seconds later in a visible earthquake scarp, a 10 to 30 foot high wall of elevated soil and rock, flung southward over forests and fields, offsetting roads and fracturing pipes, and creating instant waterfalls as seen in Kashmir in 2005. The same thing happened in Nepal in 1934, when a magnitude 8.4 earthquake caused catastrophic damage in eastern Nepal and in villages throughout the Ganges plain to the south. No one noticed the surface rupture in 1934 because it occurred far from the main road to Kathmandu. The rupture was discovered in 2012 by a Nepali-French team of geologists led by Paul Taponier, and excavations showed not only evidence for at least 15 feet of slip in 1934, but also for a historically known earthquake in 1255, which destroyed Kathmandu and killed the reigning monarch. The 679 years between these two earthquakes, when combined with a 3/4 inch per year convergence observed from GPS measurements, means that the 1934 rupture allowed eastern Nepal to slip almost 42 feet southward over the Indian plate. On June 6, 1515, a huge earthquake ruptured through the Himalaya. Monasteries in the Takula region were destroyed, as was the then new Mughal capital of Agra to the south. The earthquake heaved a wall of soil 20 feet high over the fields and forests of medieval India. At 3/4 of an inch per year, this kind of monumental quake, magnitude 8.9, can't occur more frequently than once in 1,000 years. If the pattern repeats, then a similar rupture won't happen for another 5 centuries. But what about the remainder of the Himalayan arc? Some of the most recent severe Himalayan earthquakes, in 1950, magnitude 8.6 in Assam, and 2005, magnitude 7.6 in Kashmir, occurred at the extreme ends of the arc. A small segment northwest of Delhi slipped in 1905, magnitude 7.8 in Kangra, with some other modest events in 1803 and 1833. An earthquake in 2015, magnitude 7.9 near Kathmandu, occurred at the middle of the arc, devastating Nepal's capital and villages throughout the region. Earthquake studies. Because of the wedge-like shape of the Himalaya and the Ganges sediments, 15 miles thick in the north, tapering to nothing south of the Ganges plain, the seismic waves of energy emanating from the quake nucleus will be focused southward and become trapped within the gradually narrowing bands of Himalayan sediment in southern Nepal and northern India. As a result, the dense populations of these areas could experience a more severe jolt than those living closer to the nucleus of the quake itself. During the Great Bihar earthquake of 1934, this focusing effect increased the ground-shaking accelerations by more than a factor of 2 compared to points on solid rock south of the Ganges Plains. Tens of thousands died. If that earthquake were to occur today, the death and destruction would likely be much greater, partly because of the fact that Kathmandu's population has doubled in the past several decades, and partly because of the surge in the number of buildings that are taller and poorly constructed. A major earthquake in 2015 confirmed seismologists' fears and cost thousands of Kathmandu residents their lives. Unfortunately, public officials are reluctant to believe that the recurrence of nightmare earthquakes is inevitable, Roger says, and damaging moderate earthquakes don't occur with sufficient frequency to remind people of the dangers of poor quality construction. So wherever I go in the Himalaya, I publicize earthquakes, especially among urban planners. Anticipation. Like David and Ed, other expedition leaders were concerned by the number of teams on the mountain and the potential for a jam. To avert the costly and potentially dangerous consequences of unanticipated delays, Scott Fisher and Rob Hall conferred on the timing of their team's summit attempts. Before even reaching base camp, Hall had wanted to try for the summit on May 10th. In previous years, he had gone for the top on this day, and he had the feeling it was lucky. Nearly all his clients had reached the summit in 1994, though no clients had summited in 95. Initially, Fisher wanted to try on May 9th, but when he discussed with Hall the shortage of time and the manpower needed to fix ropes high on the mountain, they decided to combine their experienced staffs. They chose May 10th as summit day for both teams, then notified the other expedition leaders, suggesting they plan around their date. Later parties, they explained, would benefit by the fixed ropes Fisher and Hall's teams would leave behind on the tricky Hillary Step and the summit ridge. David, Ed, and Robert had climbed Everest without fixed ropes above the South Col, and they knew that Jomling, Araceli, and Sumio could do so as well. They chose May 9th, a day ahead of the two large groups. For the purposes of the film and for safety, David wanted the team to be relatively alone on summit day. From base camp to the Western Coombe. On May 5th, the team lit incense at the Lopso and departed base camp for Camp 2. A part of me is excited and curious about what will happen, Araceli said. And another part of me is afraid. But this fear is what makes me respect the mountain. David maintained a positive but cautious attitude. We're right on schedule, and if the weather holds, if we remain healthy, and if the camera doesn't malfunction, we should be able to get on top and get these images. The climbers emerged from the ice fall at 19,800 feet just as the sun hit, and walked into the massive glacial snowfield known as the Western Coombe, a Welsh word that means valley or cirque. They deployed their umbrellas to block the powerful sunlight. The snow blanketing this low-angle valley acts like a giant solar oven, concentrating the sun that reflects off the walls of Nuptse, off the western buttress of Everest, and from the broad glacier valley that extends below them. When people think of Everest, they think of cold and wind. But some of the more uncomfortable conditions here are caused by excessive heat, David explained. The ambient temperature in the Western Coombe can be well below freezing, yet you can't remove enough clothes to stay cool. We pray for a gust of wind, and when it comes, our work capacity immediately rises. Losing fluid through sweating, in addition to the large amount exhaled by heavy breathing, increases the risk of dehydration, which causes a wide range of symptoms and problems. I'm trying to drink 2 to 3 liters of water a day. On rest days alone, Ed said. When climbing, we should drink at least twice that, but at high altitudes, we're often not thirsty. There's also the disincentive of trying to get up in the middle of the night. Camp 2 is set in the majestic, sculpted cirque of the upper end of the Western Coombe. The southwest face rises more than 7,000 vertical feet above camp and seems to disappear into the stratosphere. Though temperatures at Camp 2 were still dipping below zero at night, the days were warmer than when the team first arrived, almost a month earlier. In the afternoons, water flowed and gurgled over the rocks and made rivulets in the snow. On May 7th, the team left Camp 2, slowed only by their moderate pace and by the Bergschrund, or crevasse, at the base of the Lhotse face. Robert recalled that 2 weeks earlier, Yasuko Namba, who was not entirely confident using an ice axe, had to be pulled up the 50 vertical feet of the Bergschrund by a Sherpa. At the ledge on top, Sumio met Namba, and the two nodded and bowed while they spoke politely. They were clearly wishing each other the best of luck, Robert said, but I could sense something of an air of competition between them. The team climbed the steep Lhotse face to Camp 3, where tent sites had been carved out of the face itself. High winds continued to blast the southeast ridge far above them, and a mood of nervous tension prevailed. Their faces were swollen and sunburned, and they spoke little about the mountain. Ed stirred a pot balanced on a small stove. "Well, we'll have some beef stroganoff for dinner, although Spam and Dijon mustard would be a more complete meal. Spam is high in protein. It comes out in convenient chunks, and you get 170 calories from only 2 ounces. Araceli rolled her eyes. Sumio turned the videotape camera on Ed, and he conveyed a message to Paula. The cassette would be taken to base camp by a Sherpa the next morning. "We're heading up to the South Col tomorrow," Ed said confidently. "Please don't worry about me." "I'm worried myself," Araceli interjected quietly off camera. "Mostly about being cold." Sumio finished the taping and turned to Araceli. "Which socks will you wear for the summit?" She was aware of Araceli's problem with slow circulation. "Oh, I can't decide between the red ones and the pink ones," Araceli feigned. She had commented earlier that modern climbing gear may be lighter and warmer, but that the mountain hasn't changed. "Your equipment and your body must be ready. But summit day will be the most difficult because you are weak even when you start out. It will be the other climbers, the team, and the teamwork that will determine whether we reach the top." 3 days earlier, Sumio had cracked a rib from violent coughing. She had cracked another one 3 weeks before that while establishing the high camps. "Though this injury is painful, little can be done to treat it. My cough hasn't stopped, but my ribs seem to be improving," she said optimistically. The rest of the team looked at her with sympathy and hope, knowing how much she wanted to try for the summit and to install Roger's GPS and weather stations. "You know, I didn't tell my father that I was coming here to climb Everest," she added, sensing their concern. "Now she tells us," Ed said. "We're strong, and the rest days were good," Jomling said optimistically. "But I miss my wife. And my daughter will be 10 months old tomorrow. I'll have to try to concentrate on the climb." As they had done on many nights at Camp 3, David and Robert spent 2 hours cleaning and checking the IMAX camera and equipment. Robert worked long into the night loading film magazines with the bulky large format film. The team watched the upper part of the mountain and listened. Fierce winds out of Tibet were still funneling over the South Col, threatening to drop into the Western Kum. Robert called these gales, which sounded like freight trains, the Lhasa-Kathmandu Express. Climbers caught in the middle of them described the sound as varying between a deafening roar and an endless, nerve-rattling howl that flaps tent so violently that it's nearly impossible to talk. Sleep is difficult. While establishing Camp 3 several days earlier, David saw a tent blow past him at 60 miles per hour. On a previous expedition, he had seen all the dining tents at Camp 2 get blasted away. "Your tent will be quiet for 15 seconds, then is suddenly barraged for minutes at a time," he grimaced. "The wind saps what small amount of warmth a hypoxic person is able to generate." Ed knew that summiting, particularly without bottled oxygen, would require a relatively calm day. Each year in May, there is a period of a few days when the high winds and unpredictable weather subside, presenting a window of clear and relatively calm weather. "That's the time to go for it," Ed attested, like a fisherman imparting a secret stratagem. But if it turns bad, you have to be willing to retreat and wait. For the climbers, weather is a gamble. It can start out fine and suddenly turn worse on climbs to the higher camps, and a bad day on Everest can be deadly. There have been days in the past few weeks when we could have climbed Everest as mountaineers, David said, but not as a film team. I have to be able to hold the camera steady and change the film barehanded. Robert had filmed in extreme conditions before, on a British expedition to the unclimbed Northeast Ridge. The severe wind and weather kept us off the route for nearly 2 months, and during the summit push I had to turn back when my fingers froze while filming. 30 climbers, heading up. That evening the team looked down into the western coombe from Camp 3 and watched a stream of more than 30 people heading to Camp 2. The group included two Taiwanese climbers and some Sherpas and guides, but most were clients of Scott Fisher and Rob Hall. Every one of them would be heading up to Camp 3 the following day. Ed and David didn't need to speak. We knew right then, Ed recalls, that we did not want to summit on May 9th. The descent from Everest's upper slopes is the single most dangerous part of the climb. The team would need to pass these climbers on their way down from the summit and would have to unclip their carabiners from the fixed line and then reclip many times to get around people with unknown mountaineering skills. Would the client step on the rope and cut it with their crampons? Dislodge some ice or rock? Their presence gave me a sense of being squeezed, David said. Ed and David agreed that the team should descend to Camp 2. They would wait for the others to climb through. Besides, the moderate break in weather did not appear to be the traditional early to mid-May window of clearing, and waiting might also result in more favorable weather conditions. While they were on their way down on May 8th, the other groups ascended past them. David said he felt uneasy, as if he were bailing out on the mountain and his friends on other teams. Just above Camp 2, Robert passed Rob Hall, near the Bergschrund at the bottom of the Lhotse face. Despite the fact that the team was being extremely careful, Hall was concerned about falling ice or rocks that David and the team might dislodge onto his group. On the other hand, Robert felt that Hall might benefit by focusing his concern on the clients. Some of them were already on oxygen, though most climbers begin using it only above Camp 3. The ankles of some were wobbling, Robert said. Not a positive sign. Shortly afterward, a rock that was likely set loose by an ascending climber whizzed by within a foot or two of Robert's head. Araceli expressed the wisdom and experience of a true mountaineer. Yes. When you pass people on the way down, you think maybe we didn't make the right decision. Maybe tomorrow the weather will improve. But turning back is never a bad decision. It gives you the chance to try again. Another Catalan woman was attempting Everest from the north side, but Araceli said she felt no competition to be the first Spanish woman on Everest. If you race when you are in the mountains, you lose the safe part of your mind, she said without hesitation. A death on the mountain. Early in the morning of May 8th, Chen Yunan, a 36-year-old steel worker from Taipei, left his tent at Camp 3 on the steep Lhotse face, possibly to relieve himself. He wasn't wearing crampons and slipped 60 feet down the face and into a 15-foot crevasse. A Sherpa pulled him out. Chen told Mukalu Gao Mingho, the leader of the Taiwanese team, that he would remain at Camp 3 and assured him he would be all right. Believing his team members' condition to be fine, Gao departed for Camp 4 alongside the Hall and Fisher teams. Later in the day, the Everest team Sherpas returned to Camp 3 from the South Col. They found Chen in some distress, apparently suffering from internal injuries. They began to lead him down the fixed ropes. He was losing strength, but walking. At 3 p.m., the Sherpas radioed Camp 2 that his condition had deteriorated. A half hour later, they called again. Chen had collapsed about two-thirds of the way down the Lhotse face and they now believed him to be dead. They left his body attached to the rope and descended to Camp 2. Lying on the slope, Chen was visible from Camp 2. David insisted that they check on his condition. There was a chance he might be unconscious. The weather had turned rough, but David, Robert, and Ed packed quickly and departed. When they reached the Taiwanese climber, they could barely see through the blowing snow. Chen was dead. At least they could evacuate his body. The Sherpas would not use the fixed rope as long as a body was attached to it, although monks remind lay Sherpas that it can actually be propitious to see dead bodies, especially in dreams or when traveling. Nonetheless, many of the Sherpas are averse to seeing or handling them, which can bring defilement and thereby bad fortune, especially if there is a karmic link to the deceased. David, Robert, and Ed lowered Chen to the foot of the Lhotse face and over the Bergschrund. After packing him in a sleeping bag, they dragged the dead climber back to Camp 2 and left him nearby in the ice. He could be carried down by his teammates later. When Ed radioed Mukalu Gao on the South Call to tell him that his climbing partner was dead, Mukalu did not seem to take in the news. He was so utterly focused on getting himself to the summit that he answered vaguely, "Oh, thank you very much." I was upset by Mukalu Gao's decision to leave Chen and continue climbing because his death affected me, David said. I had to go up and bring down a dead Taiwanese climber. I had to close his eyes and cover his face. I didn't like doing that. It was a senseless death. It wasn't David's first experience with death on the mountain. In 1984, Dick Bass and David attempted Everest with the ill-fated Nepalese cleanup expedition. Team members Yogendra Tapa and Ang Dorje fell from the southeast ridge to the South Col. Sherpas stuffed their frozen bodies into a tent, but eventually the tent came loose and fell another 4,000 feet to the Western Coombe. Climbing together in 1985, David found parts of their frozen bodies, which had shattered when they hit the bottom. He collected what he could and dropped the body parts into a crevasse. On the north side in 1986, David said sadly, a Sherpa named Dava Nuru was swept away by an avalanche. Ang Purba and I found him, and several Sherpas helped us get his body to base camp. A lama was called, and he was cremated at the nunnery. When you see bodies, you don't have room for hysteria or emotions. It's a survival mechanism. But we do try to bring them down to bring some closure for their relatives. John Ling was troubled by the death of Chen, which occurred on the 10th anniversary of his father's death. At Camp 2, he burned incense, prayed, and chanted. Those at base camp did the same at the Lapso. By the 9th of May, a Scandinavian, a Frenchman, two Spanish brothers, and Euron Krop, the lone Swede, had made unsuccessful summit attempts via the South Col route. Three of them had reached the south summit at 28,710 feet, or just below it, but were forced back by deep snow and high winds. Also, a Yugoslav team had tried for the summit on May 9th, but abandoned their attempt above the south summit. They arrived on the South Col at 7 p.m., exhausted. Audrey reported that one member ran out of energy a few feet from the tents and had to be hauled inside. Like the team members and many others, Charles Houston was humbled by the mountain's size and austerity. "Man does not conquer a mountain any more than a mountain conquers man," he had written in 1953. For a few brief minutes, once in a million years, men have reached the summit of Everest and other high peaks. But how much more often have they been chased away, victims of bad luck, storm, or their own weakness? "Surely the gods live here," said Kipling's Kim, and he was speaking for many who have been awed by this magnificence. Though this was Ed's eighth trip to Everest, he was approaching the mountain with similar humility, expressed in a practical way. "You don't assault Everest. You sneak up on it, and then get the hell out of there." In depth. Kip Hodges, School of Earth and Space Exploration, Arizona State University. the highest fault in the world. Several fault types played an important role in the evolution of the Himalaya. The two most significant are thrust faults and normal faults. Thrust faults mark the zones along which sheets of continental crust are shoved over other sheets. If you've ever watched a snowplow at work, you've seen sheets of crusted snow pile up in front of the snowplow's blade. In much the same way, sheets of rock are piled up to form the thickened crust of a mountain range. Normal faults develop in a different way. They thin rather than thicken the crust. Lay a deck of cards on a table and spread them out with your hand. This causes each card to slip past adjacent cards, the same way that normal faults move, resulting in a wider but thinner stack of cards. Normal faults are usually found in regions of crustal thinning, like the East African Rift, rather than in mountainous regions. Their existence in the Himalaya implies that the range did not grow higher and thicken continuously throughout its history, but experienced intermittent episodes of thinning and collapse. These probably occurred when the crust of the range became too hot and weak to support its own weight. One of the most spectacular of the Himalayan normal faults is the Chomolungma detachment. It occurs near the summit of Everest, cropping out on the north face at an elevation of 27,953 feet, where Japanese geologist Minoru Sawada studied it in 1998. Before this discovery, geologists had predicted the position of the fault based on studies in the Rongbuk Valley to the north of the massif, where the detachment is tilted very shallowly forward, separating Ordovician limestones above between 458 and 485 million years old from older metamorphic rocks below. One of the rock units just below the fault is a band of yellow marble deposited as a limestone in the Cambrian period, then metamorphosed to marble much later during the Miocene epoch. Based on aerial photographs and field observations, the fault could be traced southward toward the mountain. From near the summit of Everest, climbers had collected rocks similar to the Ordovician limestones in the Rongbuk Valley. This, with other evidence, led geologists to speculate that the yellow marble in the Rongbuk Valley is the same rock as the famous Yellow Band, one of the most conspicuous landmarks for climbers on Everest. If so, that would put the Chomolungma detachment somewhere between the Yellow Band and the summit, perhaps at the top of the Yellow Band. To help test this hypothesis, the 1996 Everest film team collected rock samples within and just above the Yellow Band. Samples brought back from other expeditions require the fault to be below the Hillary Step, but its exact position remained a matter of speculation until Minoru Sawada's discovery in 1998. The Chomolungma detachment is almost certainly the highest major fault in the world. Everest without oxygen. The debate over the use of supplemental oxygen in extreme altitude climbing began during the first attempts on Everest in the 1920s, and has continued ever since. When I think of mountaineering with four cylinders of oxygen on one's back and a mask over one's face, well, it loses its charm, George Mallory wrote. But his colleague J.P. Farrar, an influential member of the British Alpine Club, countered. Strictly speaking, I do not think that oxygen is any more of an artificial aid than food. That mountaineers can climb oxygenless in the death zone highlights a coincidence of human and planetary evolution. The highest point on Earth is also the highest point at which the human body can function without supplementary oxygen. If it were very much higher, the summit would likely be unreachable without supplemental oxygen. At that altitude, simply surviving, not to mention climbing upward, is no easy task. When you run out of bottled O's at those altitudes, you might as well be underwater, observed climbing guide Pete Athens. You retreat within yourself. You slow down. Climbers are chronically hypoxic, and they report that the skin of other climbers has a bluish cast to it. Your body turns into a machine to process whatever oxygen molecules it can find in the thin air, David Brashears noted. Reinhold Messner said that on his first oxygen-free ascent of Everest with Peter Habler in 1978, he felt he had become nothing more than a single narrow gasping lung, floating over the mists and the summits. Although our energy for metabolism comes from food, Oxygen is the catalyst for the metabolic process, and its presence determines whether or not we can exert effort. It's eerie, Ed Viester said. If you turn someone's oxygen off, they stop moving. With oxygen, you function better, think more clearly, stay warmer, and are able to climb steadily without pausing every step to suck in 6 or 8 gasping breaths. If oxygen is so precious, why do climbers climb without it? When I first attempt a Himalayan peak, Ed explained, I climb without bottled oxygen, even if it keeps me from reaching the summit. My personal goal is to see how I can perform, to experience the mountain as it is without reducing it to my level. For me, how I reach the top is more important than whether I do. At the summit, supplementary oxygen effectively lowers one by only 2,000 to 4,000 feet, making a small and yet significant difference to oxygen-starved climbers. Once climbers are on oxygen, Ed continued, they become stronger. But it's a bit of a crutch. Without it, I don't have a mechanical apparatus that can fail on me and thereby endanger me. Most important, I'm aware of the tricks that altitude and hypoxia can play on you. While climbing, I test myself, asking myself whether I'm aware of the conditions of my actions and of what is around me. Exhaustion and hypoxia can cause one to lose it mentally, and I never allow myself to fall into this state. When I'm guiding, however, I always use oxygen. You're there for the clients, and oxygen does enable you to function better, both physically and mentally. Chapter 5. Tragedy Strikes. It was an hour past noon on May 10th, yet Rob Hall's and Scott Fisher's teams were still high on Everest, striving toward the summit, knowing that descent in the dark was likely. Cold, exhausted, and hypoxic, the guides and climbers would also face the wind and rough weather that had been settling in on the mountain nearly every afternoon for the past month. By mid-afternoon, base camp had received radio calls from the summit. Audrey sat bundled at her laptop computer and her cold fingers tapped out the day's news for the satellite fax. Today, Rob Hall, with two other guides and three of his clients, John Krakauer of Outside Magazine, a Japanese woman, Yasuko Namba, and Doug Hansen, along with three Sherpas and 9 members of Scott Fisher's group, reached the summit. We understand Mukalu Gao, leader of the tragic Taiwanese expedition, also made it up. However, all the ascents were around 2 in the afternoon, which is very late in the day. We are now anxiously awaiting news that all of the climbers make it safely back to Kaal tonight. Incredibly, 23 people had summited. But at Camp 2, the response to this news was guarded. They are making the top in middle of the afternoon? Woof, Araceli said, expelling air in surprise and worry. Ed scanned the radio but overheard only one conversation. Scott Fisher was telling his climbing sitar to inform Rob Hall that 3 of Hall's clients had abandoned their attempt short of the summit, below the Hillary Step. Ed, David, and Robert turned and looked from Camp 2 down the western coombe, in the direction of base camp. In the distance, they saw a large cloud bank welling up. At around 4 p.m., it began to roll toward them. At the same time, another cloud bank enveloped the upper mountain, several thousand feet above. At 4:30 p.m., Paula was making potato soup in the team's base camp kitchen. Geodetic engineer Dave Menson came over from Rob Hall's camp and informed her that he had just overheard a chilling radio conversation between Hall and his guide Andy Harris. Hall, who was still above the south summit, was yelling to Harris that their client Doug Hansen had collapsed and needed oxygen. Hall said he would be staying there to help Hansen. This was clearly a life-and-death situation. Paula dropped everything, and when she emerged from the cook tent, she looked up and saw thick, dark clouds moving extremely fast into base camp from down the valley. It was eerie. In 2 seasons at base camp, I'd never seen clouds like that, she said. They were dark, purplish-black. Locally generated clouds tended to roll up the valley each afternoon, but these were more ominous. When Audrey stepped outside, she was so astonished by their appearance that she called Chang Ba and the other Sherpas to take a look. They took time to examine them, then pressed their lips together tightly. No one spoke. It began to snow. Paula ran to Rob's camp but heard no further communication from Rob or others on the upper mountain. She radioed Ed and David at Camp 2. They were stunned. Rob Hall had decided to stay with client Doug Hansen near the dangerously high and exposed south summit, knowing that he couldn't get him down alone. Hall and Hansen were undoubtedly exhausted. Their oxygen may have run out, and now they were struggling through a pitch-dark whiteout in a roaring, chilling wind. "I tried to imagine what they were going through," Ed said. "A nightmare." High on the southeast ridge, the wind maintained a distant, menacing howl. David and Ed left the radio on. Confusion on the call. Sometime after 8 p.m., Paula again radioed Ed and the team at Camp 2. Information from Camp 4 was sketchy, but Base Camp had heard that just a few of the 23 summiters and other climbers on the upper mountain had returned to their tents on the south call. Only those who descended quickly from the summit, or who had turned around before the top, arrived at camp. No one knew where the others were. David and Ed knew what it was like to return to the south call from the summit. You're exhausted. And when you find your tent, you crawl into it and assume the climbers behind you made it into camp, Ed explained. You don't want to get up and check on anything or even walk around. You just want to pass out. A short distance from camp, a tragedy was unfolding. Not far above the call, high winds and snow had begun to buffet the returning climbers. Because of the danger of climbing down a steep section of rock-hard ice above the call, known as the Ice Bulge, in the deteriorating conditions, one group of 11 climbers headed slightly east of the route they had ascended. By the time they reached the call, darkness had fallen. The call is the size of several football fields and nearly as flat, resembling a vast featureless plain. The raging storm limited visibility to a few feet, and when the climbers removed their dark-lensed ski goggles to see in the darkness, they had to squint into 60-mile-an-hour winds and driving snow. They were cold, hypoxic, tired, hungry, and dehydrated, all of which reduced circulation to their hands and feet and dulled their minds. At base camp, members from every group gathered at Rob Hall's camp. Many had radios in their hands and were attempting to communicate with the climbers still on the mountain. The batteries on Scott Fisher's radios had died, and no one could reach climbers on his team. "Our heads were spinning with unanswered questions," Paula said. "Our worst fears and best-case scenarios swam together in our heads. I slept half an hour that night. Mattresses covered the floor of Rob's communication tent where 15 people were curled up like sleeping dogs, dozing fitfully. The tent was mostly silent except for some sporadic crying and praying. The Sherpas stayed up playing cards. All were desperate for information, but those on the south call responded infrequently and could give little information when they did. Helen Wilton, Rob Hall's base camp manager, made a list of names and checked them off as climbers were reported safe. Her list showed 17 people unaccounted for, a number that wouldn't be clarified until the next morning. Rob's situation was the only one we really knew about, Paula said. And all night I'd been thinking that he would never stay behind with someone and not have somehow tried to move. He knew the danger of remaining stationary at that altitude. Every climber within radio contact had exhorted Hall to come down, assuring him that a rescue team could be sent for Doug the following day. It was shocking, Audrey recalled. Here was a situation where a guide would have to leave behind a still-living client. I remember thinking it would finish him as a guide, and that he was in an impossible situation, damned if he did, doomed if he didn't. Even more shocking was the total lack of news about the 17 climbers who should have returned to their tents on the South Col. After midnight, Mike Groom and Neil Beidelman, guides for Hall's and Fisher's teams, stumbled into Camp 4 on the South Col, with two of Fisher's clients and two Sherpas. In a state of near-total exhaustion, they described to Anatoly Bukreyev, a Russian climber who was guiding for Scott Fisher, where the other climbers were huddled. Cold, exhausted, and unable to see, five more remained out near the Kangshung face on the far eastern side of the South Col, about 400 yards away. Groom, Beidelman, and the others barely made it to their tents. Bukreyev, who had just returned from climbing to the summit without oxygen, was exhausted, but he went out for the stranded climbers. Unable to find them, he returned for better instructions from Beidelman and Groom. On the next trip, he found three clients not far beyond the point he had reached earlier, and he guided them back to Camp 4. Two were left behind. Bukreyev said he didn't see Back Weathers. Yasuko Namba, if not dead, was unable to walk. Both were clients of Rob Hall. The next morning at base camp. At 4:45 a.m., Helen's radio went off like an alarm. "Is someone coming to get me?" the crackling voice asked. It was Rob Hall. Helen flew to the radio. "Doug is gone," Hall said cryptically. His voice was partly muffled by his oxygen mask. It wasn't clear if Hall meant that he had been separated from client Doug Hansen or that Hansen was dead. Hall, at least, hadn't moved from the South Summit. Paula called Ed at Camp 2 and told him to get on Rob's radio. It would be best if a fellow climber, a friend, talked to him. Someone would have to get Rob moving. Ed and other climbers gathered in Hall's dining tent at Camp 2. Several times, Hall asked, "Where's Andy?" "He was with me last night." We didn't know what he was talking about, because Hall's client, John Krakauer, had said that he had seen Andy Harris much lower down, on the South Col, Ed recalled. Andy must have been up there with Rob and Doug for at least part of the night. Rob didn't give any further clarification about Doug, either. Ed believes that Hansen could have fallen from the traverse between the Hillary Step and the South Summit, but that it is more likely he made it to the slot Hall used as a refuge near the South Summit, and that they spent the night there together. Doug must have died during the night. A difficult phone call. It wasn't until mid-morning on the 11th that people at base camp and Camp 2 were updated with news from Camp 4. Andy Harris was missing. Scott Fisher and Mukulu Gao were last seen below the balcony, the ledge at the bottom of the southeast ridge. Two bodies had been identified outside Camp 4, those of Beck Weathers and Yasuko Namba, who were lying on the South Col. At least two Sherpas and a doctor from Hall's team had hiked out and removed the snow from Yasuko Namba. One account said that her pupils were dilated, but that she was still breathing, though barely. Another said that she was completely inert. They found Beck Weathers to be on the verge of death, and the doctor may have deferred to the Sherpa's judgment that the two could not be revived. They returned to the tents at Camp 4, and it was reported to base camp that Weathers and Namba were dead. At base camp, it was agreed that Beckweather's wife should be notified before she found out through the press. Helen Wilton phoned Hall's office in New Zealand. The office manager called Peach Weathers in Dallas and told her that her husband had been reported dead and that his body had been identified. It was just after 7 a.m. Dallas time. In addition to Hall and Hansen, Scott Fisher, Andy Harris, and Mukulu Gao had to be somewhere on the upper mountain. But throughout that morning, the southeast ridge and south summit remained wrapped in clouds and furious winds, with a wind chill well below zero. The Sherpas at Camp 4 were exhausted. Getting them to head out from the South Col on a rescue effort took some serious coercing by Wang Chu, who was at base camp. Wang Chu was also the sardar for the Taiwanese team, and their Sherpas were on the South Col. Finally reaching them on the radio, he scolded them for staying in their tents. "Get up there now and look for those people," he barked, trying to sound intimidating. Remind any Sherpas who remain in camp that I'm going to penalize them the moment they set foot in base camp. Ankh Sering, Hal Sadar, similarly goaded another group of Sherpas into heading up. Wang Chu later admitted that while on Everest the year before, he had dreamed of a goddess. She was smiling, and approached him and hugged him. In the spring of 96, the dream recurred, and the goddess again smiled and approached. This time, however, she turned angry, wrathful. During the climbing season, he mentioned the dream to no one. Downward motivation. Paula was trying to be optimistic, but finding it difficult. Even if the rescuers reached Hall and the others, how could they get them down? For the entire morning, she and Helen and Guy Cotter, a close friend of Rob Hall's who was climbing on nearby Pomori, when the rough weather rolled in, urged Rob to stay alert, turn his oxygen up, and get going. Caroline McKenzie, Rob's expedition doctor, reminded him to knock the ice off his mask to get it to work properly. Oxygen would provide him the critical boost of energy he needed to start moving again. In Hall's Camp 2 dining tent, Ed and others were also on the radio to Hall. Several people were saying to Rob, "Don't worry, we'll get to you," as if trying to comfort him, Ed said. But he was far too high on the mountain to be rescued. Paula knew this too, and she reminded me to be tough with Rob, to motivate him in any way possible. Rob did need to worry. It may have been physically impossible for Rob to stand up and start moving. He would have been uncoordinated and weak after his night on the south summit, and could easily fall off the mountain. Also, before he could drag himself down the hill, he would have to climb up and over the south summit, a 25-foot rise. In his condition, this would be a monumental task. Again and again, Ed pleaded into the radio, "Rob, you've got to get up and go. Turn your oxygen on full, then crawl and pull your way up the rope and over the south summit." He told Hall not to wait for the Sherpas, but to meet them halfway. He tried joking with him. "I told Rob, you have to come down at least for your wife and new child, who I hope will be better looking than you." He laughed and appreciated that. For the most part, he was coherent. Vaka Gustafsson, a Finnish climber on Mal Duff's team, cried during the radio calls, which went on for hours. He wanted to speak to Hall, but simply couldn't. He had first climbed Everest as a client with Hall in 1992, then soloed Daulagiri in 93 on another trip with him. Vaka, Rob, and Ed all had climbed with Mukalu together. By now, Ed and others were also in tears. Ed pulled himself together long enough to speak with Rob, then broke down and turned off the radio so that Rob wouldn't hear him crying. Helen Wilton called Dr. Jan Arnold, Hall's wife in New Zealand, and held the phone to the radio. Camp 2 could hear the conversation. "Rob sounded like a different person when he spoke with Jan," Ed said. "He became more lucid, and several times told Jan not to worry about him. He was positive and strong." That was when everyone listening in lost it. "Okay, I'm going to try to get up to go now," Rob said finally. Everyone breathed a sigh of relief. When Rob radioed again a few hours later, Ed was hopeful, upbeat even. "I said, 'How's it going, Rob? Where are you now?' And he responded, 'You know, I haven't even moved. My hands are so badly frostbitten that I can't deal with the ropes.'" David and Ed looked at each other, and the distress on their faces spoke for them. It was clear now that Hall would be unable to get up and move on his own. Coordination from Camp 2. Others needed help. At Camp 2, the Everest team were preparing themselves for rescue efforts, but they first needed to communicate with Camp 4. Hall's tent at Camp 2 had a 25-watt base station radio, but the batteries of the one working unit on the South Col were dying. The South Africans had radios at Base Camp and Camp 4, the only radios on the mountain capable of picking up all the frequencies used by other teams. They had climbed to the South Col on the 9th intending to go for the summit on the 10th, but they had arrived on the col exhausted and had postponed their summit attempt. Paula and others at base camp urged Philip Woodall, base camp manager for the South African team, to contact his brother, leader Ian Woodall, who was camped on the South Col. Perhaps the radio there could be made available for the emergency. Ian Woodall refused to help. "They're on their own up there, exhausted, out of food, out of oxygen," Philip protested on behalf of his team. This didn't sound like a description of a team that was still considering a summit push, and it was clear Philip felt uncomfortable with his brother's decision. "You can't ask them to give up their radio, their one link with the outside world." "It was crazy," Audrey said, "the way the South Africans kept viewing themselves as separate from everybody else, as if on some other planet." If they had made an effort to join the community on the mountain, they would have realized that the community could benefit them as well. David told John Krakauer to rip open the team's tent on the South Col and grab the batteries. The Sherpas had insisted that the tent be locked following the theft of the crampons from the foot of the Khumbu icefall. With the radios on the Col now working, David wanted to assess the situation there before committing climbers and resources. If they were to rush up the mountain, they could get strung out and create an even more problematic situation. They needed to know exactly what kind of help was needed: clothing, food, oxygen, or rescue. "I think everyone's right at their limit now," David reported to Guy Cotter after speaking with Camp 4. "People are exhausted and hypoxic, and they're having trouble getting up and moving. There's a lot of will up there, but there's a lot of fear, too. We're trying to organize some fresh people to head up with supplies. But on our way up to Rob, for instance, how do we pass by Scott Fisher and Mukalu Gao and others who may be in equally dire condition? This may be a triage situation." Camp 4 in shambles. Earlier that morning, May 11th, Todd Burleson and Pete Athens, who had spent the night at Camp 3, bravely set out for the South Col. The Lhotse face was being hammered by high winds, and even those who stayed in their tents at Camp 3 feared being blown off the mountain. As far as Todd and Pete knew at the time, 17 people were still unaccounted for, but near the Geneva Spur they passed a haggard and frostbitten group of climbers coming down. After receiving pieces of news about others on the South Col, Pete and Todd continued on. Pete was appalled by the condition of Camp 4. "Our fears were confirmed," he said. "We saw gear strewn to the elements and the torn walls of tents flapping uselessly. They heard voices from one fairly intact group of tents. Inside, John Krakauer and another of Rob Hall's clients relayed what they knew. They said that the bodies of Beck Weathers and Yasuko Namba were lying at the edge of the Kang Shung face, several hundred yards away." Pete and Todd went to work. David had told them to take whatever they needed from the team's tents, which were filled with oxygen and supplies for their own summit attempt. "David just gave freely of whatever was needed," Pete said, "with no idea whether he'd get anything back. Oxygen, for instance, is expensive to replace. Without it, his team could lose its chance for the summit." Everyone on the South Col was inside their tents, and most were too tired to get out of their sleeping bags, even to find nearby oxygen bottles. No one had been strong enough to assist anyone else, and there was no communication even between tents, though many were no more than 5 meters apart. The Sherpas, those who hadn't returned to the mountain to search for missing climbers, were exhausted, and some were disoriented. "It was a scene from a horror movie," Pete recalled. "We had to get them down, but some of Rob's members didn't want to leave the Col without him. Only by busying myself with helping others was I able to suspend my incredulity and make the scene appear less surreal." Pete and Todd encouraged those who were ambulatory and not overly tired to get off the South Col. "We began by delivering bottles to various tents, like pizzas," Pete said. "They placed oxygen masks on several climbers and gave them liquids and nourishment." The climbers on the South Col were sinking into a dangerous condition of apathy that Todd and Pete found reminiscent of K2 in 1986, when 7 climbers trapped by a storm delayed too long on the shoulder, which, at just below 26,250 feet, is about the same height as the South Col. When the weather eased, only 3 of them were able to make a break for base camp, and one of these died on the way. 5 perished. The winds were blowing a consistent 70 to 80 miles per hour, with higher gusts, and a half-mile-long plume trailed from the balcony. The Sherpas high on the mountain had yet to return to the Col, but Todd and Pete could see that it would be virtually impossible to rescue all. As far as Todd and Pete could determine, the South African team remained in their tents the entire time they were on the Col. The Sherpas turned around. At about 4 p.m., Lakpat Sering and Rob Hall's climbing sidar, Ang Dorji, descended to the South Col. They had climbed to within 800 feet of the south summit, still 2 hours away in those conditions. They left some oxygen and a ski pole at the highest point they reached. On the South Col, Ang Dorji sobbed as he recounted their efforts to reach Hall. Standing almost stock still, while leaning into a wall of constant wind, tears streamed down his contorted face. Simply watching him was emotional for Pete, who was also despondent. Todd radioed that one group of Sherpas had reached the southeast ridge but had turned around in the battering winds. David, Robert, and Ed were climbing the Lhotse face to Camp 3 when the news about the Sherpas was relayed to David, who was 100 feet behind Ed. Ed stopped and cried. At that moment, all of us, I think, Rob included, knew it was over for him. David told me that I'd better say goodbye. But what do you say? Hang in there? The last words I had spoken to Rob were that I'd see him on the South Col. Perhaps it was best to leave him with that thought. I simply couldn't have said goodbye, even if the radio were in my hand. Our sense of hopelessness was profound, David said. Rob was only 4,000 vertical feet from us, but we might as well have been trying to rescue the Apollo 13 astronauts. There's no force in nature that can get you up the Lhotse face and southeast ridge fast enough. And there's no helicopter rescue at those elevations. Very few people have survived a night out above the South Col, and the common feature of the nights when they did was that the wind dropped. After hearing of the Sherpas' abandoned rescue attempt, Hall kept his finger on the radio. David, Ed, and base camp could hear him crying. Guy Cotter told him that someone would try again tomorrow. Rob said that he couldn't last another night, Ed said. He knew, but then he quickly turned it around and said, okay, I'll hang in there and be all right. Refreshment at Camp 3. David, Araceli, Robert, and Ed continued climbing to Camp 3. When they arrived, they worked with other guides there to set up a way station and began heating water for cocoa and soup. Before long, the stream of exhausted climbers that Todd and Pete had passed filed down from Camp 4, some of them on oxygen. The team removed the climbers' crampons, got them into tents, and began warming and rehydrating them. I was looking at the face of despair, David said, after speaking with several of them. There was an uneasy mix of elation that they were alive and a sense that something terrible had happened. Many had minor frostbite on their faces. Ed and Araceli got them up and headed toward Camp 2 before they could cool and stiffen up. If one rests when exhausted, it is difficult to get moving again. During this time, we were all focusing on Rob and the survivors climbing down, Ed continued. But Scott Fisher and Andy Harris were out there, too. And what were they going through? Shortly after the first group of Sherpas returned to the South Col, Ungoang Siakya and 2 other Sherpas also descended. They were assisting Mukalu Gao, who was barely ambulatory and appeared to be badly frostbitten. They had found Gao and Fisher not far from each other, little more than 1,000 feet above camp. Ungoang Siakya said that Fisher was barely breathing and that his teeth were clenched and his eyes fixed, unblinking. He hadn't responded when they gave him oxygen and hot fluids. The afternoon of May 11th was fading. Anyone alive now would likely be dead by morning, after a second night out above the South Col. Anatoly Bukreyev began to gather oxygen bottles, aware that he was the only one with the strength to make another try at rescuing Fisher. Pete, Todd, and most of those on the radio from base camp were discouraging him, assuring Anatoly that no one would criticize him if he didn't go. Accidents and losses can be compounded when climbers are tired, anxious, and hypoxic. When rescuing in extreme conditions, Todd said categorically, you must become very objective and very calm. And at the top of your list is self-preservation, Pete added.